Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll hear my conversation with actor Woody Harrelson. It was recorded before he received his Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor this morning. He'll be coming to Iowa City later this week, and we will talk about his film Lost in London. But first, there's a great deal we can learn about our ancestors from the writing they left behind. But to be able to learn those things, we need to be able to read these ancient texts. Paul Dilley, an assistant professor of ancient Mediterranean religions at the University of Iowa, is involved in using some new technologies to read incredibly fragile books. And he is here with me now. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, let's talk about one specific ancient book. This
Sure.
is a codex. So you'll have to help us out with the vocabulary first. What does codex mean?
So codex is just Latin for a book in the sense that we're familiar with it. So, binding and pages with writing on both sides. And it's different from what was before in the ancient world, which were scrolls, which are rolled up and there's writing only on one side of those. So it was kind of a massive media transition that happened just about the time that the early Christians were also spreading. So the first couple of centuries of AD or CE.
All right. And this codex in question, it doesn't have really a very special name. It's called M910.
Indeed, yes.
So tell me about this book. Where did it come from?
So it was discovered in Egypt at some point in the 20th century. We don't know often, well, not often, less than we would like, books are actually excavated and we know exactly where they came from. You know, were they in a pot or were they under the altar in a church? In this case, the book just came on the antiquities market and in the early 60s was sold to the Morgan Library. Now, the Morgan Library in New York City is probably, one of the foremost collectors of ancient manuscripts, and they bought it, taking a bit of a risk because it was in bad shape.
All right. And it is in bad shape. Describe the shape that it's in.
Well, so in antiquity, obviously there was no electricity. So people would read, especially the pious who would stay up late studying and praying and reading the Bible. They usually worked with candles. So it seems as though some kind of ember came loose and burnt its way through the codex. There's fairly extensive burn damage. The codex is actually in parchment, which is a kind of animal hide basically used for pages. And so that warped it, stuck many of these pages together, and basically just made it, in the opinion of the conservators at the Morgan today, too dangerous to open. So there's no really way to read the book as we normally would.
All right. So the book cannot be opened because it would basically fall to pieces.
That's right. Yeah. There would be a real danger of, maybe not kind of just automatically revert to dust in its entirety, but there would certainly
be
little bits falling all over the place and would make it illegible.
All right. So you can't open it and you can't read it. What was the value of the book to the Morgan Library? And we're going to talk about technology that hopefully is allowing you to get a peek inside the book.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the value to the Morgan Library and Museum in New York in buying this book that couldn't be opened and couldn't be read back in the 60s?
Yeah, they were collecting early biblical manuscripts. And so this is not certainly among the very oldest biblical texts, but for the particular book, the Bible, Acts of the Apostles, it's one of the earliest. So it is for that reason, I think they took a chance that somehow, some way, either their conservators would be able to do it by hand, which didn't happen, but they at the same time were acquiring a number of other early biblical manuscripts, so they wanted to make this part of their collection. And, you know, it was a risk, and ultimately, hopefully, we can make it pay off for them 50 years later.
And how do you know that this is Acts of the Apostles?
Well, so the dealer in the early 60s did actually open a few of the pages, and so the pages that were images were taken then, and you can still actually see the front page, and those all very clearly show the Acts of the Apostles in Coptic. So Coptic is the language of Egypt. It was discovered in Egypt, and so they spoke Greek in Egypt too, but in this case it was translated. So it's Coptic Acts of the Apostles.
And how did you find out about this book?
Well, I'm an aficionado of Coptic manuscripts. I study early Christianity in Egypt as my main the main region that I look at because it's arguably the most exciting. And so I knew of the Morgan Library's collection. They have a very high quality collection of early Coptic manuscripts. And just from reading the description, often there are volumes published which just state what books are in there and what their contents are. I was familiar with this particular unopened book, and I thought to myself, wow, it would be nice to read that somehow.
Okay, now let's talk about the somehow, because this is where the technology enters the story. Dr. Brent Seals is a computer scientist at the University of Kentucky.
That's right.
And he has developed a system that has been used on scrolls in the past.
That's right.
For actually getting images of what's written on the scrolls without unfurling them, because obviously a lot of those scrolls would fall to pieces if you did that. So
yes.
What kind of technology are we talking about here?
So a couple of things going on. He's doing amazing groundbreaking work in taking X-ray images, so tomography, to read actually all of the layers of an unopened roll, and in our case, an unopened codex, and then taking that data there and running it through various image processing algorithms, what Brent calls the virtual unwrapping. In the case of a roll, the roll is already curved, so you need to kind of virtually unroll that. And then the next step is to identify the writing on this unwrapped roll. You have to find a way to make it appear against the background, whether that's papyrus or parchment in the case of the book we're working on at the Morgan.
Okay. So it's an X-ray.
Yes, indeed. So right? you need an X-ray.
And what made you think that that technology might work with this book? Because with the scrolls, there's only writing on one side of the page. With a book, there's writing on both sides of the page.
That's right.
That's got to make it a lot harder.
Yeah, so this is part of the very exciting nature of the project for both Brent and myself. Trying to take this method that has been successfully applied to rolls and then looking at whether we can actually make it work with the codex. And so what we get colleague at the Iowa Center for the Book, Melissa Morton, had put together a kind of facsimile, a model of the manuscript before we actually went to the Morgan to do it. And tests were made, X-ray of that facsimile, which had some writing inside it as well. And the resulting data suggests kind of an alphabet soup. So you have evidently the ink kind of, even though if we could open the book, it would be clear, probably clear, what side a given letter is on. Is it the front, the recto side, or the back, the verso of a page? But the X-ray, because the ink kind of bleeds into the parchment, the X-ray just doesn't necessarily assign it to one side or the other. So what I will be doing in tandem with Brent and his team is basically trying to take this alphabet soup and figure out a way to say, okay, this is on the recto, this is on the verso side. So, definitely something that hasn't happened before, so we'll see how it goes. But it's exciting because, we get to kind of think about best practices for doing this because there's plenty of other unopened materials in the world of cultural value. So if we can kind of lay the groundwork for doing this properly, it will be great.
So when it was proposed that this system would be used on this codex, there was another obstacle that arose because the Morgan Library deemed the codex to be too fragile to be moved anywhere.
Sure, yeah. I mean, conservators, it's their job to care for these precious collections, and they quite rightly have concerns anytime somebody wants to take a part of their collection and move it elsewhere. So, you know, the issue was whether or not this could be moved across, you know, the East Coast to have the X-ray done in a lab. So it was not possible, but certainly we were able to work around that. So,
and how did you work around that?
Well, so there was a company in Pennsylvania which graciously allowed us to use a smaller X-ray, a portable X-ray scan of sufficient quality to actually take good images. So they kindly provided us with a scanner and a technician, and we went from there. So we worked actually at the Morgan Library in the basement, but a great basement.
And were you there as the scans were being taken?
I was there, yes. So this was four days in December. I guess it was the week of the 18th. Very exciting. Lots of organizational excellence that had to be done to get everybody, you know, to make it happen. But it did, and you know that's thanks in large part to the Morgan Library and also the company. So.
So those scans were taken in December and completed mm-hmm. in December.
Yeah.
Once they're taken, I know the result is kind of this alphabet soup. But what has to be done to the scans before a scholar like yourself can really dig in and start sorting all those letters?
Well, I defer to Brent. He's the one who's developed the algorithms. But essentially, you take the data and apply it to the algorithms, and that will modify the image. So literally, virtually unwrapping it. And the physics of this is that you need to have the right material in the ink to interact with the X-ray in a different way from the surface it was written on. So in our case, we were lucky. We had an ink made of iron gall, and so that shows up well against parchment.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Paul Dilley, an assistant professor of ancient Mediterranean religions at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, my conversation with actor Woody Harrelson. He's bringing his film Lost in London to Iowa City on Thursday. He'll be screening it in front of an audience, and then we'll do an interview on stage, he and I, followed by a Q&A session. You'll hear more from him in a few minutes. But first, we're talking about reading ancient texts and X-ray technology that allows us to look inside a historical book that cannot be opened because it is so damaged. Paul Dilley is here with me, an assistant professor of ancient Mediterranean religions at the University of Iowa. And we've been talking about this text. So the scans have been done. Right now, the numbers are being crunched and the algorithms are running. So that when will you actually get to see what's inside?
Literally in a day or two, we'll begin the process. And, you know, we're hoping to go from the back of the book to the front because first we have to figure out if there's another writing besides Acts of the Apostles in the manuscript. I think not, given a word and a letter count and the estimated number of pages, it's probably just Acts, which would make sense. There are other books of the same age like that, but, you know, we have to make sure. And also, you know, we'll have to see which pages are the best and the easiest to read because, you know, just in developing this process, we want to start with the easiest thing to do and then go from there. But the good news is Acts of the Apostles is a known quantity. If this were an unknown text, it would be super exciting in that sense. You know, we'd discover a new ancient writing, but we wouldn't know what to expect. So I think as a first go at this process, we're lucky to have this.
So You've already read Acts of the Apostles in Coptic before?
Indeed, yes. Here and there, absolutely. Yes.
All right. So in that sense, you have seen probably similar text from a similar period.
That's right.
So it gives you kind of a roadmap as you go through this alphabet soup to put the letters together?
Absolutely. Putting the letters together would be straightforward if we knew which side the letter went on. So that's the kind of new and difficult thing about doing this. I mean, there are other situations. I'm editing other texts with colleagues, one at the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin from the arch-heretic Mani, an early Christian heretic. And there, the writing is difficult to read, and we have other techniques like multispectral imaging. But usually there, the question is faded ink, and, you know, can we actually read what we think we're seeing? Here, it might be that we can see the letter, but we don't know which side of the page it's on. So very strange.
All right. Now, I don't read Coptic, surprisingly.
Fair enough. That's okay.
But when
you can always learn.
maybe soon. When you look at the images, you're talking about trying to see whether it's on one side of the page or the other. If we were looking at the alphabet that we're familiar with, you would be able to see that the letter is backwards, right? If it's on the back side of the page.
Sure.
Is that not the same in Coptic?
It is the same in Coptic, okay. But there is also the issue of facing pages, and there are symmetrical letters. So a number of the letters are actually dependent, are asymmetrical. So for that, and actually brainstorming with Brent about, you know, possible machine learning and algorithmic ways of trying to make it automated to do an initial assignment of recto or verso, the question of symmetrical versus asymmetrical letter forms is going to be key.
All right. Yeah. Now, as we were just talking about, this is a book you've already read in the language in which it's written. What might be different in this text? What makes this process worthwhile?
There's the process itself. So, honestly, for me, the most exciting part of this is developing this new technique on a known text, and it's the very fact that the text is known which makes it doable. So,
okay.
Between you and me, I mean, you know, this is a step forward in that direction.
So, almost creating a key that you can use to unlock other works.
Exactly. Yes. On the other hand, it is an early biblical manuscript. It's anywhere from the 4th to the 6th century,
wow.
Probably a little bit later on that spectrum, but we don't know for sure. So there are limited witnesses to the Bible from this period, and every one of them has generally some kind of strange variant.
Of course, these books were not being reproduced with a printing press. They were
exactly.
being written by hand.
That's
so
a very important point.
So whoever was writing it may have made changes or interpreted the text differently.
Yes, that's a very important point. So this is manuscript culture, not print culture. And the monk or the pious Christian or the, you know, paperwork scribe, any of them might have introduced error or perhaps even their own reading, or they may have memorized the text and just remembered it wrong. So, you know, for any number of reasons, new kind of what we call textual variants wind up in these codices.
There's no way to know this, but how long do you think it's going to take you to read this text once you get those images?
Very hard to say. I mean, a traditional editorial work would basically you'd have a codex or a manuscript or a papyrus you're trying to read, and you just sit down, and it might take you years or it might take you a couple weeks to read it and then establish the text and publish it. So for this, it's not even 100% clear what the end game is, because it's possible that we might get great images for part of it and not so great images for the other part, and so only part of it would be published. And of course, you know, we're also focusing here on establishing best practices. So any publications will also have to grapple with what are we doing to read this? And also there's a question of peer review. So how can people actually check to make sure that I'm reading this correctly? So it's a major issue there. But ultimately, sure, we'd like to be able to read the whole thing.
I can imagine that unlocking this key could lead you in some very exciting directions. So I don't want to get way ahead of ourselves.
Sure.
But what's out there that you're hoping to be able to read in the same way?
Well, there's a ton of different material. I will be mum on specifics as far as what I'm interested in, but there's certainly material that the Herculaneum papyri are probably the holy grail of this kind of unopened, unread ancient writings.
And then tell me more about
those. So, those were discovered in the 18th century in Herculaneum near the Italian city of Naples, basically charred because of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. And they're well preserved, but they're very brittle. And basically, people have been trying to unroll them, usually with very little success. So if Brent's technique can be successfully applied to reading those scrolls, then we might get all sorts of lost ancient literature, not biblical literature in this case, but not classical literature by Greek and Roman authors, poets, including some famous ones. So, you know, who knows? Some of the lost books of Livy, the historian of Rome, it could be waiting to be discovered.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, we read about your work in the New York Times, and I'm sure that other scholars probably have had their eye on this for some time. But have you been hearing from a lot of other scholars saying, hey, I want access to this technology. I have this project in mind.
Sure. Yeah. There are various groups interested in doing this kind of work. There is a meeting in Rome on February 20th. Of a group doing the archaeology of writing, so looking at various imaging techniques and trying to move forward on establishing wish lists and just collaboration. So I'll be a part of that. My colleagues on Facebook and social media there have definitely been conversations about this process. So, yeah, it's really exciting moving forward.
So you also recently published a book. You've been studying early monastic life, and
that's right.
Book is Monasteries and the Care of Souls in Late Antique Christianity. So in trying to study the lives of monks,
yes,
in very early Christianity, I mean, you're not only looking at works that might have been produced by monks or scribes during this time period, but the lives of the people who would have been devoted to this kind of work. I mean, how do you even begin to try to unravel what life might have been like?
Yeah, it is definitely very careful and exciting detective work. I mean, you're often looking at writings that very few people have read for centuries, but massively important. So Egypt, where this biblical book was discovered, was also the place where monasticism was developed. So people professing lifelong celibacy, but not only that, other kinds of athletic things like, you know, that we might think of as almost like training, staying up all night, doing prayer routines, which involve bodily movement, but also training the mind. So what I did in that book was actually look at what I see as a very particular aspect of monasticism. So their classical forebears wanted to train people to speak well and act well, but monks were trained to speak well, act well, and think well. So there was a real concern with training the mind and basically trying to rein in thoughts that were seen as tempting or negative. So what I do in that book is try to unravel this process of monastic thought training. I call it cognitive disciplines. And it's really one of the few and earliest areas in the ancient world anyway, certainly in the West, where people were, you know, really theorizing how we think and how we can change that if we wanted to.
And what time period are we talking about?
We're talking about the 4th century and the 5th century. That's okay, the majority
so this,
of
the same time period that this book that we've been talking about would have come from.
Indeed. And one of the ways monks trained their minds to kind of push out bad thoughts and get in good thoughts was memorizing the Bible. So there's a technique called the anti-reticus, or literally talking back. So if you felt a demon was tempting you to have sex with somebody that you shouldn't, or to eat food that you shouldn't be eating, or to go to bed when you should be up praying, then there were biblical verses that you could speak back to that demon and conquer it. And the other thing is, just by memorizing biblical words, you almost became subjectively a biblical person and hopefully a virtuous one. So this is one area of thought training.
So and the people who would have been drawn to the monastic life at that time, I mean, Christianity was still relatively new. So they wouldn't necessarily have had a Christian background, right?
That's right. There were many who were actually what we might call pagans and would have worshipped gods that we might think of as Egyptian or Greek or a combination of the two. So very diverse background. Monasteries in particular, I show in that book, were drawing on people from a wide variety of status, class, backgrounds. Some of them would have been Christian before, others not. And the one thing was, generally speaking, it was the elite males who were eventually became the abbots of these monasteries. But you often had male monasteries side by side with affiliated female monasteries.
So because Christianity was relatively new at that time, I mean, trying to put it in terms that I could understand, thinking about our culture today.
Sure.
I mean, they were kind of new age or...
Yes. absolutely. I mean, there's a concern with eating habits and trying to not necessarily for living longer, although some of these monks, there's one, Shanuta, who the best evidence suggests he basically lived for 120 years,
wow.
So which I think would be close to a record. And that's not based on – I mean, it's the best of our evidence suggests he really lived that long. And is that because he only had 1,000 calories a day? Maybe.
You
could have contributed to it.
You can write a New Age diet book next.
There
right?
you go.
So when – when you are trying to learn about the lives of these monks and this kind of movement, what kind of texts can you draw on to recreate that life?
Yeah, so the bare bones, you might say, are monastic rules, which kind of give you an idea of the institutional regulations and how the day was structured, how the community was structured. But for doing these cognitive disciplines, trying to uncover those, the best are kind of homilies or speeches that the monks in authority would have delivered to their disciples to try to encourage them or to rebuke them or to do things like teaching the fear of God. So this is the other cognitive discipline. You had to imagine the kind of shame and guilt you would feel. Basically, you imagine yourself naked on the last day with everybody looking at you, but they can also see inside and see your bad thoughts. So everything that you've been covering up would be exposed. So this is called fear of God, and this is one way that monks recommended for expelling bad thoughts.
So obviously, as a scholar, you have an interest in this time period and the works of this time period and the people who were involved in creating these works.
Yes.
What do you think someone like me should know about this time period? Why is it important to understand this part of our history?
Well, I mean, it's a massive time of religious experimentation. I mentioned the cognitive disciplines. There's also, as far as what might go under the rubric of spiritual but not religious, which is a growing part of the population, the kind of monastic experiment with prayer and training the mind to try to get the mind to leave the body and to contemplate. Contemplation is not just of God, but it's also of nature. And there's a real kind of developed theory of the mind that monks put forward, which I think is relevant. I mean, and not just because it sounds a little bit like cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, it does. But beyond that, there's plenty of interesting stuff for spiritual people.
Well,
today.
It also sounds they're so much like us. What is old is new again.
Absolutely.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking with me today and helping us look into the deep past.
Absolutely.
Paul Dilley is an assistant professor of ancient Mediterranean religions at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about using new technology to read incredibly fragile ancient texts and also his research into early monastic life. He just published a book called Monasteries and the Care of Souls in Late Antique Christianity. Coming up in just a moment, my conversation with actor Woody Harrelson. We recorded this conversation before he received his Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor this morning. He'll be coming to Iowa later this week, and we'll talk about his film Lost in London. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.